Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show, Saturday, February 21st, 2009. We are live today from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States, as we are weekly. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and today we have a four-person panel to discuss this topic, the fascists versus Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then and now. I'd like to introduce them first and to welcome you to this discussion. And let me begin with two people off the phone and then to our studio guests. But we welcome Dr. Clifford Kirikoff, who's professor of history and political science at VMI, that's Virginia Military Institute, and also Washington and Lee University. Welcome, Cliff.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
And we also welcome Jeff Steinberg, our counterintelligence director at EIR News Service. Jeff, I hope you're connected and welcome. If he isn't, he'll say hello soon, I'm sure. And Jeff has been collaborating, as Cliff has, with John Hoeffel here in the studio with us, our chief economist. Welcome, John.
Hi, Marcia.
John and Jeff are just finishing the second of a two-part series on this general topic, the fascists versus FDR then and now. And you will see that in EIR Online within 4 days. And finally, our fourth person we very much welcome in this studio, Alicia Serratani. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
From the LaRouche Political Action Committee, the LaRouche Youth Movement, who is likewise part of the team working on this, including,
Hello.
I think, upcoming. And that's Jeff. Hi, welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Marcia. How you doing?
Good. I said you'd be here, and here we are. And Alicia, I think, is also part of an extended team working more, putting things together for LPAC TV, possibly. So we are meeting right now to discuss this at a time when people can have their eye on Washington, D.C., but all around the country, in different states, city councils, and other localities, there's an intensified discussion now of the emergency measures LaRouche put out a couple years ago, especially after July 2007, formulated this in terms of what's known as the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. And in many states, for example, Florida this past week, resolutions that we need this kind of a LaRouche emergency measure approach, which is in the spirit of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And at the same time, there's intensified opposition to this, like crazy. And that brings us around to what we are discussing today, which is need-to-know history about who would obstruct emergency measures, not just to save the United States, but to save civilization. So, John, if you want to begin by characterizing the nature of who these enemies are, their pedigree then and now, and kick off the discussion.
All right. Well, if you start with the group that was the most vocal opponents of FDR was a group of financiers who were pushing a fascist movement in the United States. But what this really is this is the British Empire, the Anglo-Dutch financier oligarchy, who have been out. The target was not really FDR. The target was the United States of America, the American Republic. And they were determined to prevent FDR from rebuilding the United States, which they've worked so hard to destroy ever since it was founded. And so the idea was that, you know, FDR had said we didn't fight this war to preserve the World War II, to preserve the British Empire. And he was looking at changing the world structure after the war. And they were determined to prevent this. And so these financiers funded all of these various fascist groups as a way of building political opposition inside the United States to try to stop the emergence, the reemergence of this American Republic phenomena. And that is the same thing that's going on today, and it's basically the same circles who are doing this to stop it for the same reason. They don't want the Obama administration to implement, you know, LaRouche's ideas and start and restore the sovereignty of the United States. And that's basically the fight. It's the empire versus the republic.
Right. Now, do you want to... One there's continuity in between, which we definitely want to hear about. You know, you've just gone into then and now. But do you want to discuss more names and the kind of coagulations that they took in the 1930s?
Well, at the center of this web inside the United States in the 1930s, sort of the spider at the center was J.P. Morgan, the interest of J.P. Morgan. And Morgan, the Morgan around the Morgan Bank. And the House of Morgan was the most powerful financial institution in the United States and perhaps the world for a while. And it was formed in Britain and basically transplanted into the United States. And its job was to take down and assimilate the American system of economics. That the Morgan was out to bankrupt the American system industrialist, take over all of their resources, and then, you know, bilk it on behalf of the empire. And that's what he did. And so Morgan, who at one point controlled, you know, more industrial corporations than anybody else in the world, probably as an individual, and as this network of institutions, was not an industrialist at all, because basically his job was to destroy industry and destroy the American system. And that's what Morgan was. And then they used all the money that they made from this process, and they financed fascism in the United States.
Right. And you just hit on one thing here about the transatlantic character of this. In other words, we're talking about the same time as what we know as Mussolini, the expression of the Mussolini fascism in Italy, and then the expression.
Yeah, because the Morgan interest and were allied with people like the DuPont family and others, and they were financing and big supporters of Mussolini. They helped finance Hitler, and they were close with the French Senecist. So there was this network of fascists around the world, and it was a global movement run by this brutish empire. And so the U.S. side of it is one component of a global move, but the U.S. arm was also helping to fund and organize the movement overseas. The United States, for example, Mussolini was on the cover of Time magazine more than once. And there were a lot of people who were praising Mussolini and wanted to use Mussolini's program as the way to get the United States out of the Depression. I mean, these people were serious fascists.
Right. And speaking of their, before leaving that time, although we can return, we can go back and forth, but the formation at this time of action groups, and you mentioned media control, Time magazine, included the Liberty League.
The American Liberty League, which was the dominant financing of that came from the DuPont family. And, of course, the DuPont corporation was built largely on munitions. It started out as a gunpowder and dynamite manufacturer and has always been a major player in the munitions business. And so you had that group, the munitions industry, like Bethlehem Steel and others, were financing a lot of these groups. And you had the American Liberty League, and then it spun off things like the Crusaders, the Sentinels of the Republic, the Southern Committee to Uphold the Constitution, and a few others. So they were actively organizing and spreading this around the country. For example, the Southern Committee to Uphold the Constitution was formed in Texas by networks associated with the circles of Colonel House and the King Ranch.
What are we talking about? The 1930s, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it was organizing in the South, you know. And if you remember that it was the Woodrow Wilson administration in which Colonel House was sort of the eminence grise, the British intelligence agent, which was involved in spreading the growth of the KKK in the South and around the country. And then those same networks, this KKK networks, became a big part of this anti-FDR movement. So it all ties together quite nicely.
Now, obviously, with everything FDR was doing, I mean, he won re-election. He succeeded, I mean, thanks to many of the physical economic improvements. We're here today, and there's a chance for civilization. But up through the, and also there was a coup attempt vanquished.
Yes, these networks, the American Liberty League was the main instrument of trying to organize a coup to basically take control of the U.S. government to overthrow FDR. And this coup was known as the business plot, and it was blown by the guy they selected to be the leader of it, General Smedley Butler, who, instead of going along with the coup plotters, exposed them. And so this was a very famous case. And basically, because of, for political considerations, is because FDR was trying to rebuild the country more than prosecute these guys, they sort of got away with it, although basically the House of Morgan, with the financial reorganizations that FDR pushed through, was took a great hit and has never fully recovered.
So then to, not to go too fast forward, but up through the problem is following the Second World War, and of course with the great loss and death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, then there's the regrouping of whom you're describing. They could just go right ahead.
Yeah, they had to change their policies, their tactics a little bit, because, you know, one of the things that makes the empire so successful over the years is it's willing to adapt. It tries different tactics. The strategy is always generally the same, but the tactics change. And so you had a relaunching of these movements through the creation of one, what George Ball called in 1968 the World Company, the cartelization of the global economy, and then the creation of a giant financial bubble, which increased the power of the financier class inside the United States. So the United States has been taken over largely from inside by that kind of a thing. So that today you can see with this bailout that, you know, the power that the financiers have over our country.
Yeah,
and then the emergence of things like the neocon movement, which is sort of the modern version of these fascist movements. So fascism is very much on the rise, and you can also see it in the continuing push by the government on behalf of these financial interests for this Big Brother approach. More spying on everybody. You know, now they have this, they're talking about tracking everyone's driving.
Oh, GPS.
Yeah.
It maps your position and what tolls you can pay by what hour.
Yeah. You know, so now this grouping is committed to spying on everyone all the time.
Well, let me ask Cliff, this might be these intervening decades. We roughly began with the 30s and we're up to the present, but the post-war decades and the continued morphing of these kinds of operations. You've stressed the different right and left wing versions of it, right?
Yes. Well, this historical continuity, we can see it in the post World War I era in the 1920s, where you have the rise of fascism and Mussolini, as John was saying, and then developing into the 1930s, where the Wall Street operators are bringing the European style of fascism to the United States to oppose Franklin Roosevelt. And then we have the same pattern after World War II. So the pattern after World War I is now being repeated in the pattern after World War II. And you have the networks established by the American Liberty League that John talked about and others in the Wall Street interest linked formerly to the European fascists in France, in Italy, in Spain, in Germany, you name it, in England. Coming into the 1950s, we're looking certainly on the Republican Party side at the McCarthy phenomenon, for example, and the extreme right wing of the Republican Party got its backing from these elements that John was talking about in the pre-World War II and World War II era, the American Liberty League types. Your interests like the Hunt oil interests or the Pew oil interests or any number of former American Liberty League sponsors pushed the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. And Senator McCarthy, of course, was the most well-known example of that. But it persisted certainly in the William F. Buckley networks, for example. also on the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. And you can work your way right up into the 1960s, certain elements of the Goldwater campaign on the extreme right. Even Goldwater himself felt they were too far right, by the way. And then those elements that Goldwater himself was concerned about began to form what was called the New Right in the 1970s, and that became an important component of the Republican Party, kind of reworking the Republican Party in the 1970s and 80s, the so-called New Right. And then that, in turn, linked up with what we would call the Christian right, or the fundamentalists, like Jerry Falwell and Hagee and those folks, also financed by former Liberty League types. And I must say, Billy Graham himself was a creation of the Liberty League types. He was a creation of the Hearst interests and Henry Luce of the Time Life. So the role model would be Billy Graham, but Graham was a little bit more careful to stay, quote-unquote, a bit more moderate than some of these other characters. So that's how you get the Republican Party going off to the extreme right, or that particular faction of the Republican Party going off to the extreme right. And that would bring us right down to, for example, Ms. Palin and McCain and those elements that just were defeated, fortunately, by the Democratic Party. But then on the other hand, in the same time period, you have the Democratic Party being penetrated by the American fascist circles, as Franklin Roosevelt said, the economic royalists. And you're looking at the Truman Democrats now and the Truman administration and some of the extreme elements of the Truman administration that moving through the last several decades, you kind of end up with somebody like Senator Lieberman on the extreme right of the Democratic Party and others. So it's not just a phenomenon of one party. These people are clever enough to try to penetrate all parties, so essentially they can't lose, quote-unquote. So they worked on the Republican Party, they worked on the Democratic Party, and they're trying to organize, if you will, a sort of a fascist Punch and Judy show between the two political parties in the United States. In short, that's what I would bring forward. If you go back into history, however, you're looking at certainly Woodrow Wilson was a creation of the British, and as John pointed out, Colonel House from Texas. Colonel House's dad was a British businessman who settled in Texas and became quite wealthy. So you have that Texas faction in the British interest. And heck, if you go way back into the 19th century, in the United States, for example, you see all the forces that oppose the Whig Party and the concept of internal improvements and different kinds of economic policies in our own country that would create jobs, et cetera, also protective tariffs, things along those lines. So it's similar economic interests promoting these things, whether it's after World War II or right now with McCain and Palin, or in the 20s with the fascists at that time in Europe or in the United States. So it's a similar pattern, and you can trace it all the way back to the European reaction in the early 1800s and mid-1800s, the extreme right in Europe, the extreme right either in the Roman Catholic world or in the Protestant world, but the extreme right, or even in the Russian side, but the extreme right reaction in European history after the Napoleonic era, for example, because they tried with the beast man Napoleon too. But so this is not a new phenomenon. This extreme right reactionary phenomenon is a good couple centuries old, and what we're getting at right now is the intensification of it during the Franklin Roosevelt administration, which we now see just all around us today. It's a carbon copy.
Right. Well, speaking of today, or you've certainly sketched in a couple of hundred years, and we can come back to different parts of that. I'd like to, including that 1800s period. But one thing is, there's a Could someone maybe wants to volunteer the particular lines that the media capability of this rotten gang, these networks that you've described?
As I mentioned, the Hearst Empire was certainly part and parcel. That's William Randolph Hearst, was part and parcel of this grouping in the 1900s, early 1900s, 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. So William Randolph Hearst and the Hearst interests would be a primary vector. There were other very large press groups controlled by similarly conservative reactionary-type people. And also you have the Henry Luce Time Life publishing empire. And, of course, Henry Luce was a Yale graduate, a member of that secretive elitist Skull and Bone Society, just like George Bush and his father. So Henry Luce created the idea of the so-called American Century. So you'll see in the Time and Life magazines, in Fortune magazines, in the 1920s, 30s, as John mentioned, praising Mussolini, even pro-Hitler in periods. So the use of major media, as you point out, the use of large and powerful media organizations is a part and parcel of Wall Street, of this financier interest strategy. And it's an instrument, it's a tool, it's one of the tools that they use to propagandize and mislead American public opinion. Also to create hysteria in the 1950s, the Cold War hysteria. Now we have the hysteria about so-called Islam and these sorts of things. Now, of course, there is real terrorism, but on the other hand, there's an awful lot of hysteria. So again, it's the power of the media, and of course now with television replacing newspapers, television and other more modern forms of propaganda instruments make it much easier for the Wall Street element and their global fascist brethren to get away with their scheming.
Hey, Marsh, could I throw in something for a second here?
Please do.
Because I've just having been kind of putting this whole American Liberty League phenomenon under the microscope over the last few days, it's very striking that they established a certain modus operandi that we see very much repeated today. Even though they were financing all kinds of racist and populist grassroots movements like the Silver Shirts and the remnants of the Huey Long movement after he was assassinated, the main thing that the Liberty League did is they operated out of the National Press Building in Washington. They had an entire floor and about 200 full-time staff people at their peak of activity.
They had a larger organization than the Republican Party did in Washington.
And a larger budget. They had about $1.2 million in their first few years, which by current dollar terms is over $1 billion. Imagine a think tank today with $1 billion slush fund. What they did is they produced pamphlets, propaganda tracts. They were distributed to about 350 news bureaus of newspapers from all over the country, every wire service, all of the key editorial writers of the major newspapers, through organizations like the Hearst Organization and the Luce Organization. They were given free access to radio time. Every member of Congress, House and Senate, received all of their pamphlets. So in other words, they were very much deployed to shape the opinion shapers. They did some leaflets for mass distribution, but by and large, their MO was to lobby Congress and to then coordinate that with planted editorial pieces in newspaper articles. The pamphlets themselves formed the core of every subsequent attack against Roosevelt and the New Deal, to the point that the current round of trash FDR books, from Jim Powell's book in 2003, FDR's Folly, to the Amity Schlaes book that John mentioned earlier, these books are really nothing but kind of reprints and slight updates linguistically on the body of material that was produced by the Liberty League in the 1930s. So they sort of, you know, set the general path for what we see today with outfits like the Heritage Foundation, Cato, American Enterprise Institute. AEI, by the way, was really established as the American Enterprise Association back in 1938 up in New York. And it overlapped very strongly with members of the Liberty League directly. So we see a historical continuity right to the present day. In the front lobby of the Heritage Foundation, there's a big plaque devoted to Richard Mellon Scaife, Joe Kors, and Edward Noble. And, of course, Mellon Scaife is from the same Mellon family as Andrew Mellon, who was, again, one of the board members of the Liberty League. So the methods and even the continuity of these families, to a very great extent, more than I had anticipated, remains the same to this day.
And they can perpetuate their work through so-called tax-exempt foundations, where they put hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, into these foundations, and then those foundations produce the same kind of propaganda you were just talking about.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Well, one thing, I mean, you've mentioned Amity Schley's, this book, I think, was it called The Forgotten Man or something, saying that poor people have been forgotten, like poor Andrew Mellon or other characters, just completely turning things on its head, lies and all this and that. Let me ask Alicia, you may want to throw something in or even a question or comment, but you're thinking of how to go out, maybe do some LPAC TV or something about this kind of thing. And you have to take into account, you have a whole population, whatever their age, who's very uninformed about what Franklin Roosevelt did, even if they aren't patsies for any old lie. They don't know anything. Is that what you've been thinking about?
Yeah, so you have to figure out where you want to start. The EIR and LPAC has an incredible amount of source material on it, and if you really start digging, you can see that the move to push fascism inside the United States really, after President McKinley was assassinated, there was a real move to get right into the foundation and the roots of the nation and really infiltrate the leading institutions, whether they be the federal government or the banking institutions, and just operate top-down and spread a certain pessimism, extinguish the American spirit from the population, which really gives the leaders of the country their power, and you have the population behind them. And if you just, a couple of the articles I was looking at and around this period, more towards, you know, Roosevelt being elected, was what was happening in Europe with Mussolini, mostly, and then eventually Hitler. But the DuPonts and the Morgans were very much a part of bringing Mussolini and Hitler to power. And they probably put more effort, well, they did, they put more effort into those war efforts, that, you know, the our enemies' war efforts in World War II, than they did in backing Franklin Roosevelt. And they did that from inside our country, which is an interesting irony. But the other thing I would say is that the Roosevelt's treatment of and his reforms of the banking institutions is not separate from his building up of the United States economy. He couldn't build up the United States economy without really, you know, holding the PCORA hearings, launching the SEC, the Glass-Steagall Act, etc. And what young people I know have been robbed of is that the if you see the way the fight is coming down right now on should we have an FDR policy or not, people are picking up all these talking points about, well, should we just have infrastructure for the sake of infrastructure because that's what Roosevelt did, or which is really just it's a crazy discussion, because what people don't recognize is that if you don't have infrastructure and building up your physical capacity, launching different science experiments and just a real priority in that direction, that's the only way you're going to keep a population from being treated like, you know, how they treated people in feudal times, you know, under imperial times, which is exactly what the current critique of FDR really has behind it.
Right. And I don't know, John, you might want to say more, or anyone, about this 30s. You, Alicia just summarized all these regulation acts and others that were put in against the this big onslaught to prevent them, like even in electricity. But also public credit was made available.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Liberty League crowd were pushing two things. One is they wanted to stop labor organizing. They did not want labor to get a fair shake because, like most oligarchs and oligarch wannabes, they believe that when their corporation makes money, it's because they're smart and not because people work very hard to make these companies work. And so, you know, they want to keep the labor unions down. And so, you know, they were very tough on labor, and they would hire goons to go in and beat up the labor organizers and things like that. And then the other thing they were big on, which we also see today, I mean, we don't see so much the goons going in, but you see the same kind of a policy towards labor. But you also is tax breaks, that they didn't want to have to pay taxes on their incomes. They wanted the labor union guys that they were beating down to have to pay all the taxes because they didn't think it was right for rich people to have to pay taxes. So, you know, their whole idea was to set up a society in which it's dominated by the rich. This is your classic oligarchic conception, dominated by the rich, that all of the society is organized to make life easier for the rich, and that the people are treated as just peasants, as throwaways, that you use them up and then you get rid of them and you get some more peasants. You know, but it's this classic oligarchic society, and that's what they were pushing, and they were very nasty people.
Well, let's fast forward to right now. We do have an email I'd like to throw out. And, Jeff, you might pick up on this one. It's from Adam R. But he is asking the panel that could somebody give more of an insight into Mr. Geithner and his thinking? Who is this character? What is he really like? Because obviously referring to all the initiatives and especially this past week and what Mr. LaRouche has been saying on the LaRouche Political Action Committee site about Mr. Obama not being well served right now by Mr. Geithner. But, Jeff, do you want to say something about this?
Well, if anybody else wants to jump in, feel free. I mean, I'll say a few things quickly. Look, you know, I think that you're dealing with two problems here. You're dealing with a problem of lack of understanding of real economics, which is a pervasive generational ideological problem. And Mr. LaRouche has been addressing that in a trilogy of recent papers that have appeared in EIR and are posted on our various websites to try to get at what some of the really axiomatic principles of real physical economy, which no modern economists have been trained in whatsoever. There's secondly the fact that Geithner is a creature of Wall Street and the Treasury Department, that symbiotic relationship that was particularly intense during the Bush-Cheney years. So in a certain sense, he really doesn't know much about the world outside of those events that transpired between the New York Fed, the Wall Street banks, as this crisis unfolded. And there was a kind of a tendency to say, we've got to protect ourselves and put people last and put the bailout of the banking system first. They think about economy as a byproduct of finance rather than the other way around. Thirdly, I think that there's a question of strictly, do they have the guts to face the reality that they certainly are in a position to know? We've been told by people in and around the administration, and Mr. LaRouche referenced this at his webcast about a week ago, that the very proposals that they rolled out for how to deal with the financial collapse, they themselves know will not work. They know these are doomed to fail policies, and in effect, they're buying time. The question is, are they buying time to muster up the courage to accept what LaRouche says and go with a bankruptcy reorganization? Or are they trying to buy time hoping that the tooth fairy is going to step in and solve the problem for them? We don't know the answer to that yet.
Well, there's no question in my mind that Geithner and his ilk, Geithner, for example, he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, and, you know, that Trilateral Commission and other groups like it, the Bilderberg Group and these other groups of high-powered international oligarchs, all think about the same way. They want to save their skins. And as John pointed out, all of the rest of us are serfs and peasants and slaves and whatever in their view. So you've got to have a coming to senses of the folks inside the Beltway and in the White House that, look, they have to think like Franklin Roosevelt did. There's a global crisis going on. It's an international crisis going on. And here at home, we have to take some very strong moves in behalf of the productive economy and the real physical economy. And as I was saying earlier, you know, we have this in our own history. In the 1820s, the 1830s, we had tremendous industrialization here in the United States, and we had infrastructure. We had, in those days, roads and canals and all sorts of what they used to call internal improvements being done. It got political, and the Whigs Party supported that type of infrastructure development, and their opponents opposed it, not dissimilar to today. The Martin Van Buren's of the world of that period opposed the Whig internal improvements and infrastructure projects. So we're dealing with a continuity even within our own republic, as John and Jeff pointed out, that really goes back to really the very beginning of our republic, if not before, and it's those who wish to link themselves to the global oligarchy, British-led, if you will, but the global oligarchy, and those who favor our patriotic citizens of a republic. And I think that's really where we are right now, and the boys on Wall Street, the Geithners, and all these characters on Wall Street, and trying to advise President Obama, President Obama needs to think more in terms of the FDR solutions. And he needs to really study, I think, FDR's solutions and a little experimentation, too, on FDR's part, but and get back into that mode. And, of course, that's precisely what the modern day American Liberty Leaguers, the modern day American fascists in the Republican Party, in the Democratic Party, the modern day American fascists do not want President Obama to take up from where Franklin Roosevelt left off. They want to derail him into Trumanism, or they want to derail him into something else, but they don't want Obama to reach back to that Franklin Roosevelt example. And Roosevelt knew very well, he was from that upper class of people, he knew very well who his enemies were. He knew them personally, and he knew exactly what they thought, and he talked about it very often. And so he knew precisely what he was doing as president and in terms of who his personal political enemies were, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's plantation economics, basically, is what they're pushing. That the idea is, you know, if you listen to them with the tax cuts and you have to protect the money, that it's that the only if the people in the big house have more to eat than they can possibly eat will there be anything left over for the servants and the slaves.
We get the crumbs.
Yeah, we got the crumbs. So if they don't have, you know, if you cut back on them, there's nothing for us.
Yeah, it's Wall Street versus Main Street, and it's been that way, you know, for decades. Well, it's Wall Street versus Main Street. That's where we're headed.
One thing is, some of you on this team, I know, had some terrific quotes. Jeff, you have an article where the 1936 campaign speech by FDR specifically goes after these networks the way that Cliff just said. I don't know if you have any of that near you. He may not be.
Yeah, I do, actually.
But was this when FDR was still campaigning or after he had won that election?
This was, the one specific speech that I quote here is from October 31st of 1936. It was the last major rally before Election Day in 1936. It was a big, big rally at Madison Square Garden. And Roosevelt basically said, for 12 years, this nation was afflicted with hear nothing, see nothing, do nothing government. The nation looked to government, but the government looked away. 9 mocking years with the golden calf and 3 long years of the scourge. 9 crazy years at the ticker and 3 long years in the breadlines. 9 mad years of mirage and 3 long years of despair. powerful influences strive today to restore that kind of government with its doctrine that that government is best, which is most indifferent. For nearly 4 years, you have had an administration which, instead of twirling its thumbs, has rolled up its sleeves. We will keep our sleeves rolled up. We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, and war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. We know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hatred for me, and I welcome their hatred. Now, a week later, Roosevelt won the 1936 elections by the biggest landslide victory in history up until that point. He got 61% of the popular vote, and he won 46 out of 48 states. He only lost 8 electoral votes to the Republican candidate, Alf Landon. So while the Liberty League had tons of money, the backing of Wall Street, the backing of London, they clearly did not have the backing of the American people, and that's what counted the most when it came to that election.
And that's the important point. I mean, the nation-state is a superior form of political organization to an empire. And when a nation-state operates as it should, then it will beat the empire every time. So the only way that the empire can really succeed is to corrupt the nation-state, which is why we have things like Fox News today, right? But, you know, we can beat them. We just have to, we have to act like America, and we can beat them.
Right. One thing that in various people who've mentioned, as Cliff did, about physical improvements, you know, in the 1800s, and we had some in the 1900s, and so one thing we've had among the evil opposition to these physical improvements of the condition for mankind and for our nation is they came up with the green, especially with the green stuff in the last few decades. I don't know, Cliff, if that goes back much farther. You know, in other words, resources are all used up. Or I'll take an example. One of your right-wing Democrats that you were sketching out, one of them comes to mind is Scoop Jackson from Washington State.
Sure, sure.
I think he helped organize a law be passed and set up a water commission. He was in the Senate for a long time. I forget what year he did this, where you weren't allowed to be technologically creating water management systems to move water from one river basin to another. Well, that's absurd.
Yes, it's also, you know, kind of unscientific. And this is something that I think is a national disgrace. The fact that we, in the 1900s or 1800s, we had these marvelous canals being built and highways and roads being built and port infrastructure being done, the Erie Canal, for example, all these fantastic projects. And then we had later on, of course, under Abraham Lincoln, we had the Transcontinental Railroad being built. Now, today, you probably wouldn't be able to do that because somebody would say, well, you know, you're setting those rails over some piece of cactus somewhere that's endangered, you know.
And prairie dogs, I think.
Prairie dogs and cactus and all of that. So we probably wouldn't even have a Transcontinental Railroad if it would be up to these sort of so-called environmentalists. And so in our own history, we've had men and women of vision at the local level, at the state level, at the national level, and spurred on, and as John emphasized, the optimistic point of view through their knowledge of science and engineering and all the unlimited possibilities before us, a very optimistic, can-do American point of view, a very dynamic, what's the problem, let's go out there and solve it kind of a point of view. And that's been our national psychology since the very beginning. And we saw that also in the spirit of Americans trying to move through this very difficult 20th century, made difficult because of our fascist networks that we've been talking about. Nonetheless, the American people buckled down and worked hard in World War II to defeat fascism. And frankly, here the American people sacrificed their lives around the world in the Asian theater of battle, in the European theater of battle, in African and Middle East, to free the world from Nazism or Japanese military aggression and all that kind of stuff in our grandparents' time, or parents and grandparents' time. And, well, what happens? Well, right after the American people help liberate the world from global fascism, the fascists are right back at it with the Truman administration and people like Dean Acheson and all of these, and the worst, Paul Nitze and all that crowd of so-called geopolitical specialists that basically... Today, what's the difference between, when you think about it, what's the difference between the Cheney and George Bush administration from the very language that Jeff just read to us in the 1936 speech of Franklin Roosevelt? As Jeff was reading those words, I was thinking to myself, darn, that sounds a lot like Cheney and Bush, you know. So this continuity that we started out our conversation with almost an hour ago, this continuity of extreme right-wing fascism, it goes back, and as John pointed out very well, and also Alicia, let's think in terms, they're trying to take us back to a feudal age, when that is precisely what the age of reaction was after the Napoleonic era in Europe. These are feudalistically minded people. They have an oligarchic elite who gets to have all the goodies, and the rest of mankind are basically animals, and they just get the crumbs left at the table. So this is a very real political battle today. And as we look at the forces arrayed against our President Obama, it's the same powerful forces arrayed against President Obama. And so we have to, I think, be a bit sympathetic with him, but I would certainly hope that President Obama can rise to the occasion and learn from Franklin Roosevelt's experience, as he has apparently from his readings of Abraham Lincoln and that experience. So perhaps we could get our president some bedside reading about Franklin Roosevelt and have that as a shining example for President Obama to have in front of him as he meets the very same horrific, evil challenges that beset President Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah, let me throw in a pitch here, because this creating this kind of pressure and support and environment that you're just talking about, Cliff, needs every citizen counts in it. Those of you who are listening live or listening later in our archive show today know that there's an EIR 800 number you can call. It's 800-278-3135. 278-3135, that's 800. And I'm sure Alicia can tell you more, but look on the LaRouchePack.com website and see the ammunition that's being put out there to change things rapidly. It needs everybody's resources, their time, their money, their contribution. If you aren't subscribing to EIR online, you should do it now. And LaRouche Political Action Committee is conducting a mobilization by the hour. So I just throw that in there because this is obviously a turning point time. And we can pick up in the remaining minutes. We still have about 12 or so forth, any point anyone wants to make. But one thing I'd like to anyone to jump in and characterize, people, you can get misimpressions about you're being fed them about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the 1930s, and so forth. But sometimes people think, gee, was it just a bunch of big guys who were wrong, who actually made cornflakes and produced oil and ran railroads and so forth? They couldn't really be these international fascists. They were just big captains of industry or something. You get a lot of load of that kind of crap. Although the Mellon family, I'm from Pittsburgh, and the reputation there they have is they made all their money from foreclosing on mortgages. So forget anything else you might hear. But anyway, John, again, this question that these networks over the centuries or in particular since the 1800s. Globalization is another word for imperialism and fascism, and they weren't just associated with big companies or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's what you're dealing with is a system of beliefs, this imperial system, this oligarchic system, which believes that a small handful of people have the right to rule everyone else. It's this sort of the law of the jungle in which they see themselves as the kings of beasts. And everyone else is either something subservient to them or something that they should eat when they get hungry. You know, and that's their view of the rest of us. And that's why the American Revolution was run to establish the nation state, to establish the principle that it is the human being which counts, that we are not animals, we are humans, we have the power of creativity, the power of reason, and that if we harness that power, we can change the world we live in. And that's what makes us superior to them when we stand up on our hind legs and act like it. And so their view is that we're cattle and they should call the herd however they see fit. And our view is that it's time to put them into some sort of a park or a zoo and let's get on with rebuilding the world. You know, we should leave the medieval age behind. It's screwed up enough. Let's move on.
Right. Well, one thing in these networks over recent decades, let me just ask any of you about the dramatic element of pushing dope legalization, speaking of enslaving people.
Well, let's not forget the British did that to the Chinese in the 1800s. The old-fashioned, what do they call that? The old-fashioned opium wars back there in the 1800s. So this technique of pushing dope on a civilization is a British technique that we saw in China, what was it, about 200 years ago.
I think another aspect that's come up with a particular vengeance in the context of this complete global financial collapse is that the core of British financial power, imperial financial power, is with the dope trade and with their control over the offshore money laundering centers. The head of the United Nations Agency for Combating Drugs and Crime said basically the only loose capital in the world today is drug proceeds, and now we're seeing a series of major, pretty stunning busts, the Stanford case, the Madoff case, these Ponzi schemes, which we're finding are actually money laundering operations for organized crime. The next upcoming issue of the EIR, which will be posted electronically on Monday or Tuesday at the latest, will feature a very lengthy updated study of the size and scope of Britain's doping today. And the figures that we've come up with are that the proceeds, the illegal proceeds from the global drug trade, have now surpassed $800 billion a year, headed really up towards $1 trillion. And that's not counting the guns that are laundered and often bartered for drugs, the smuggled diamonds and other precious metals, the white slavery, which is a major, surprisingly large organized crime business today. This is what the nature of the modern financial empire is. It's really organized crime controlled by the highest levels of international oligarchies using things like the offshore financial centers to make it all happen. So someone like a George Soros, who puts maybe $500 million a year into propagandizing for drug legalization, is making tens of billions of dollars a year because some of his entities are directly involved in laundering the drug money. So it's kind of like a major multinational corporation putting a certain amount of money into advertising.
Yeah, and then this money is, using derivatives and other things, is leveraged up, you know, 30, 40, 50 times to have a real impact. And this is what has, you know, now this leverage bubble has collapsed, and this is what they're trying to protect. And this is what all this bailout nonsense is about, is, you know, looking to have the, basically to charge the peasants for bailing out the lords.
And another point on that, on narcotics, is this issue of how the narcotics proceeds finances international terrorism. I mean, the Al-Qaeda boys and all these various Middle Eastern terroristic groups, heck, they're making all kinds of money off of that Afghan opium and heroin trade. So there's a lot of terrorism and crime, violent crime, that goes along with the narcotics trade.
Absolutely. I don't know if Alicia wanted to say something further on that. I know you guys have been doing some work on this whole narco-terrorism phenomenon globally.
Yeah, again, obviously LaRouche has the clearest picture on it as something that's dynamic, because the situation in Afghanistan and in Pakistan that's been totally destroyed by being at the center of this whole thing. Jeff, yourself and LaRouche is also constantly making the point that it's not about Afghanistan, but it's about the market that exists in the rest of the world. And you begin to investigate that, and then you see this real ugly apparatus centered around people like George Soros that's actually trying to create a drug market by forcing it down the throats of young people and old people alike. And so you, again, get this real nasty whiff of a real feudal push on the population. And it's, I think if you refer to this recent trilogy that LaRouche had just finished and is up on the website, he finishes, the last installment is just a very clear picture of the potential mankind has to grow up and out of these sorts of barbaric forms of government. And it's a very unique perspective to have, because otherwise if you just take history or current events as piecemeal, then you're never going to get the bigger picture of development, which is actually the true nature of mankind. And that's what these factions refuse to acknowledge. And that's why at this point the system is collapsing on themselves. They're actually going to go down with this collapse. Our fight is to make sure that the rest of the several billion people don't go down with them. So I'd refer to Lynn's, to LaRouche's papers, the trilogy, on how to avoid something like that, and just the clearest perspective on how this kind of thing works.
Right, and in the final minutes, any one of you might want to stress how, I mean, John has put it in terms of they leveraged up the bubble, and now the thing is burst in a leveraged way. It's not, but you can't put anything together. I mean, whatever the feudal beast might be trying to do to come out on top of the heap, it's impossible. I mean, they are going to.
Yeah, it's the system is dead. There are two approaches. One is we put the system through bankruptcy and begin to rebuild under the American system. And the second is that you attempt to save the system by basically forcing everybody on Earth into austerity and dramatically reducing populations. You know, fascism. It's either to go back to the American system or descend into a fascist hell. And that's where we're going.
And I would just put in that this is precisely what the vision that Franklin Roosevelt had as World War II was coming to a close, successful close, thank God. Franklin Roosevelt led the idea of the Bretton Woods Conference, which was all about international cooperation in the world of finance in the post-war, the post-war trauma, the global trauma of World War II. So, again, you've got an example of leadership, which Lynn LaRouche talks about, too, of the Bretton Woods idea that was promoted by Franklin Roosevelt, looking toward the future, looking toward repairing and moving through a very traumatic period of history, World War II, that is. So, again, looking optimistically, it's certainly within human reason and ability to refashion, in a sense, the spirit of Bretton Woods and to tackle these large catastrophic financial situation we're in right now. As Lynn says, we just tackle it and work hard to remedy it.
That's very optimistic. And Alicia, let me come back to you again. You might do you want to say anything about some of the initiatives? You're just the LPAC TV and other things. You're trying to proliferate ways in which people are engaged to act now on the for the reasons it's now or never.
Yeah, there's a lot to look forward on the LPAC site, but if you just start with the assumption that you know, your viewers understand profound ideas, and especially in a position that we're in terms of losing civilization potentially, then we're going to make sure that everything, that the website is stocked with all of the background they need to understand what's going on, but then actually how to think creatively, which is, we have a couple of things in line, but the real driver of it is just having the assumption that people will be able to understand and reason through a crisis like this, and to creatively come up with the sorts of solutions that someone like the Obama administration needs to get a grip on right now.
Good. Well, let me say this in conclusion, besides thanking everyone. The next show, February 28th, is going to have a panel from the LaRouche Youth Movement and Larry Hecht from 21st Century Science on the crazy myth and hoax that there's free energy. There's windy energy. There's sunny energy. And in fact, it's costly. It's part of the collapse to think that. So that's February 28th. And then March 7th, we're also going to have an entire hour on reviewing this world of this George Soros dough-pushing apparatus internationally, again, with the team. And so be sure to check the website. You're listening, of course, unless you're listening by telephone, to laRouchePub.com. And be sure you're subscribing, and that's 800-278-3135. But otherwise, today I want to thank, it's February 21st, 2009, Cliff Kirikoff, Alicia Ceratani, John Hoffel, and Jeff Steinberg. And we'll continue next week. Thank you very much. This is Marcia Mary Baker.